We just want to do a disclaimer before we start the episode. Things discussed here can be graphic, traumatic, or potentially triggering to individuals. So keep in mind who is listening and be mindful of how it will affect them. This is Life on Duty, a podcast giving firsthand accounts from the first responders regarding scenarios that have affected them emotionally or mentally and how they've dealt with it.
Dobby here. We just want to let you guys know that this episode is going to contain themes of child abuse and child endangerment, and we just want everyone to know that there's a potential trigger for those listening. So if you have any sensitivities to those things, this may not be the episode for you. What's up, guys? Welcome to another episode of Life on Duty. This is Dobby here with Oz in the background like usual, and we have our first nurse today. She is Boo.
Hi, guys.
Boo, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself?
I have been a nurse for 12 years. I have been an ER nurse for 10 years. So, yeah, that's what we're going to talk about today.
Just to give a little background here for Boo, Boo was the first nurse to ever get in an argument with me for giving narcotics.
Well...
Because I gave fentanyl to some drunk guy
that was very intoxicated,
and
she
didn't know me at the time. So whenever I arrived with the patient, she was like, "Are you aware that you're giving narcotics to an intoxicated patient?" I was like, "I am aware of that."
That's funny. You remember?
Oh, it's every.
It's
one of my most enjoyable experiences.
I was so mad at you.
Yeah,
too.
Right. Yeah, I was like, legitimate.
What am I gonna do with this guy now?
And then I feel like we just went off on like a good track after that.
Yeah,
like you had to yell at me first, and then you're like, "Now we can be friends."
That's kind of how it goes, though,
it
right?
It seems that way, for sure.
Dobby always appreciates being belittled.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
That's
why
we hit it off.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I feel like that's how I know, like, well, they can tolerate me or they can't after this. That's usually how that goes. Well, Boo, we're here for an experience that you have to share, and I know you're very nervous about it, but
yeah.
We're going to get through it together if you want, and the show is all yours.
All right. I have two stories that I'm going to tell. They sort of go together, I guess. But both of these patients have affected my career and me to this day. I think about both of these patients every day. And I think, I talk about how it's important to shut it off after you leave. You have to leave work at work. And you still have those that are always in the back of your mind. Everybody in healthcare has those patients that are in the back of their mind always. And these are two of mine. So. The first patient was, they're both kids. I should preface that. So he was two. I had just gotten back from maternity leave. It was my first or second day back from maternity leave. So my emotions were already out of whack. Anyway, I was helping another nurse. I think she was getting ready to go on lunch, or I was relieving her for lunch. And they had brought this child back with the mom and I think maybe the uncle or something. And I go in the room to assess him. And I notice his head is huge. Like his head is swollen, the entire head. And the mom said she was concerned because she said he had fallen on the coffee. And so, of course, that's suspicious. Your whole head isn't going to swell from falling on a coffee table. Right. And he was alert. He was ambulatory. He was, you know, doing his thing. He was acting like a kid. I think he had a little toy with him. So I start my assessment. He was wearing a onesie. I had brought a gown in to get him changed. That's standard in the ER. We get everybody changed into a gown so we could assess them. And I started noticing bruises.
Patient-like at the time?
Normal two-year-old.
Okay.
Normal two-year-old mentation. Like I said, active, playful. I mean, he had a distant look in his eyes, I can remember, that I thought was unusual for two-year-old. But again, I was a new mom, so I wasn't super familiar with two-year-olds yet. But nothing stood out until I started helping him get changed into this gown, and I just saw bruise after bruise after bruise after bruise. And I looked at this mom, and I locked eyes with this mom, and she knew that I knew what was going on. And so I stepped out, and I called security because I knew I had a child abuse situation. I mean, this child was severely, severely abused. So we ended up counting the bruises. Calling DFS, you know, it's a whole thing. He had 60 bruises and he had a iron mark to his back. She had burned him with a clothes iron. This
oh,
2-year-old.
A clothes iron.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it was an imperfect triangle with the little holes. I can still see it in his back. And this child had been so abused. And I think it's important, you know, that I talk about how his mentation was. This was his life. This was what he thought life was.
Right.
He wasn't even aware that being abused to this level was abnormal. He had so many bruises. His head was so swollen. He was still functioning. So this woman had been abusing this child every day.
Yeah.
So this ended up going to, and that's the end of the story. I mean, it's not really that huge of a story, but it was just something that stuck out to me because I thought, first of all, it was my first child abuse case after having a child. Once you have a child, it is different taking care of pediatric patients. And I think every parent can relate to that.
Can you maybe explain for the listeners who don't have children, like maybe how you think that changes?
So I did, for 10 years, I was a advocate for sexual violence. I worked at a center that would go in for like rape cases or child abuse cases. And I was an advocate. I'd come in after they would make their report to the police or after the assault or whatever occurred, and I didn't have kids then. And so I dealt with a lot of kids who were molested, women who were raped, a lot of just really horrific things. And at the time, it was just really easy to shut that stuff off because I couldn't relate. I didn't have a little kid who I could put in that place, I guess. And so once you have kids and you think, how could somebody do this to their child? This is, you know, something that you're supposed to love and protect, and you created this being and you're just abusing it every day, hitting it every day, burning it with an iron. Like, you can't relate until you have a kid. And so it changes things in a way that's difficult to explain, I guess. But I guess you just picture your kid in that scenario.
I just feel like 60 bruises is obviously excessive, but like, you know, sometimes like you could grab a kid, they grab your kid by the arm
right.
or something. And, but like, then you start talking about the iron burn and, you know, that's something that I feel is, you know, it just doesn't happen. You know, that's not something like the kid doesn't just go lay belly down and,
right.
and take it, you know, or in the moment, like it's an exchange that's happening. That's pretty significant.
And so of course the mom wasn't forthcoming about how he got that burn. So that just kind of leaves it to your imagination, which
right.
almost makes it worse. Like, oh my God, what kind of torture is this poor kid going
yes.
through? That he got burned in the back with an iron.
Well, I immediately wonder, like, what's happened to him that we can't see?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, your imagination just really goes. And mine did for a long time. The mom ended up going to prison.
Oh, that. Yeah?
Yeah. So it was a big case. But it was just, I guess I had been off for so long. This child was so innocent. And to see that level of abuse, I don't think I had seen that level of abuse in my career. And it was just, I just can still see that iron on his back. And I think about him every day and I wonder how he's functioning and how he's doing. And that was 8 years ago.
So there was no way for you to follow up because you're helping someone, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of the hard thing about the ER. There's not a lot of follow up. I read in the paper that the mom went to prison.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I found that out. But
what kind of residual effects did you have? You said it affected you for some time.
I couldn't even talk about it. I couldn't talk about it at all. And I couldn't take care of pediatric patients for a while.
How long?
No kids. I still have a hard time taking care
is
of pediatric
right?
patients.
And yeah. how long ago was that?
8 years.
When you say pediatric patients, are you talking like under 5 or under 18?
Probably under 8 or 9.
Okay. What happens if you do?
So I have a very close team that I work with, and they just sort of know, like, this isn't really a patient for Boo.
Oh, that's good.
So I've had a few that I've taken care of, but I have a really good team that I work with.
Yeah, it sounds like a fair support system for
yeah.
an ER room anyways.
Yeah.
Did it affect your home life?
No, not really. So I have a really wonderful husband that I can sort of decompress with. I can really talk to him about how I'm feeling. He doesn't know about these cases. I don't talk to him about the really, really bad stuff because I don't want him to know about the really bad stuff. I don't want anybody to know about the
He's
really
not on the job.
Stuff. Right. But I have a good support system and him. I think it's affected me at work, I think it's affected how I view people in society. I think it's affected, you know, I say that we should shut it off. I have a hard time shutting off these two cases.
For sure.
They're the ones that I think about when I'm laying in bed at night.
I think we all have stories like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it happens, and, you know, that's probably just another day in the ER, right?
Yeah.
And nobody thinks second thoughts to Boo coming in from maternity leave.
Yes. Maybe she shouldn't relieve this lunch. Well, but nobody knew. That's not what the kids signed in for. That wasn't like a really obvious. Right. I mean, the head swelling, you think somebody would have. But things were run a little differently back then.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. I want to hear your second story before I ask any more questions, because I know that I'm probably going to, I don't want to have to, repeat them or anything like that.
My second story, I was the triage nurse on this particular day, and a dad comes in carrying his child. She's probably 7 or 8. She's been burned. So I immediately take her back to one of our trauma rooms, and, again, we're getting her into a gown so that I can assess her burns, see what's going on. So the dad is obviously very panicked, and he said that he was trying to get her into the bathtub and that the bath was too hot.
How old is she?
7 or 8. So as I'm looking, she is fully covered, her back, her legs, her arms, the back of them, and I think they were probably second-degree burns.
Yowza.
Yeah. They were bad. The child, though, is severely autistic, so she's nonverbal, and she's rocking, and she's just rocking and rocking and rocking, and I don't think she never cried. I don't think she had the capability or the capacity to cry, maybe because of her autism. I'm not sure. She never cried. So I'm looking at the dad, and I'm looking at the patient, and the dad is just freaking out. But not about the patient. He's freaking out about his girlfriend. She's afraid that, not the patient's mom, but what his girlfriend is going to think. So I get her into her gown, and there are no other nurses in there, and she just keeps reaching for me. So I would have to stop what I'm doing and hold her, and then we would just rock together. But you have to be careful because she has all these burns,
right?
And they're bad burns.
Mm-hmm.
And they're on her back. And normally when you're laying in a stretcher, you're laying on your back.
Yeah, did you say legs as well?
On her legs, yeah. So as another nurse and I are kind of assessing her, seeing where her burns are, we realize that she's also been sexually abused.
Oh.
And I won't go into the details, but it was pretty obvious. Pretty severe sexual abuse. And so I'm dealing with a 7 or 8-year-old who is autistic, nonverbal, cannot fend for herself, who has, I'm assuming, been thrown into this very hot tub, burned. However, I mean, she didn't just get into this tub. Somebody put her in this tub.
Not to be wildly inappropriate, but like, was like her genitals burned as well, or was the legs that stopped before that?
Her genitals were not burned.
Okay.
They were bloody.
Okay.
And I just remember, as we were, you know, assessing, we both came to that realization. We're both seeing that she had been sexually abused. We both look at each other and we're just like, oh my God, this poor child, this poor child. The dad ends up running. Before he ran, he said, my girlfriend is going to be so mad, and he just runs out of the ER. At this point, the mom had arrived. They don't all realize that we realize what's going on, I don't think. I think the dad suspected that we suspected abuse, but not sexual abuse. The mom is on her phone. She is texting. She is paying no attention to what's going on. She is not worried about this child at all. I even look at her at one point because I was the triage nurse. I had to leave this patient with this other nurse. But there are a bunch of things to do whenever you're dealing with a burn victim. You know,
of that significance as well.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You have to start an IV. You have to, take care of the wounds. You have to put sterile cloth on them. You're putting water on them to try to control the pain. And burns are very, as you know, very hard to control the pain. They're very painful, and you just can't hardly achieve a good level of pain control for those patients.
Well, and you have a young woman who's unable to communicate
right.
with you. So it's all intuition-based.
Right. And I just remember looking at the mom and saying, don't you want to hug your child? Don't you? Because this child would just grab for me or grab for whatever nurse, and we'd have to stop and just hold her and rock with her because she was... Autistic kids will rock a lot because it's just, it's kind of how they deal with
stimming.
Overstimulation. Yeah, stimming. Yep. Yeah. And so we would just kind of take turns. I remember taking my badge off and my stethoscope and just holding her. And, you know, we were all wet and covered in whatever she had on her, plus, you know, the sterile water. And the mom just did not care. She had no interest in this child. She was on the phone texting. She had no interest in this child at all. And I just thought, how awful that this child is in this situation. She has a horrible dad. I don't know where the mom was. The dad's worried about what his girlfriend's going to think. She's got sexual abuse going on. She's severely burned.
Do you think the mom realized there was sexual abuse going on?
I don't think the mom cared.
No.
I don't think the mom cared at all. So I know the child ended up getting transferred. She almost died. And that's, I guess she survived. That's the extent of what I know about the outcome of that. But
if it's okay, I'd like to just talk to some people here that might not be on the job. So when we're talking about burns, it's like a high susceptibility for infection.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure that we go by rules of 9, and they alter with kids, but I'm pretty sure this is like 36%. Or is it going to be?
I think it's 50.
Is it? No, you think it's 50?
Yeah, because I think...
Is it 18 per leg?
Yeah, I'm pretty
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, so it's going to be...
I mean, I can go get my book, but...
I think it was closer to 50. It was, it was a bad burn.
The burns are going to cover almost 50% of her body. That's what you're going to edit, me saying that. So, there's a lot of variables going on. Also... When we're talking about second-degree burns, depending on what level of second-degree burns we're discussing, we're talking about, like, possibly skin slipping off or blistering pretty severely. That's how we recognize a second-degree burn, is if there's, like, usually blisters occurring or they've already ruptured. And then third-degree would be where it's severely damaged past feeling. But second-degree is usually in the most painful range because of the nerves aren't affected yet. It's, like, right on the edge kind of thing.
Yeah, the patients that were verbal that I've taken care of with second-degree burns, it's just, oh man, I feel so bad for them because there is no level of pain control that I can achieve in the ER.
Right.
I've never been able to make a burn victim comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're just giving narcotic after narcotic after narcotic. It's just...
There's also other issues like temperature regulation.
Yeah.
Once they have enough significant burns, they're not able to regulate their own temperature appropriately. Sometimes when you go into burn ICUs, they'll have almost like heaters on the ceiling to vent to the patient so that they can be heated externally. Also, there's all kinds of other issues where fluid comes and goes, where it's not supposed to come and go because of swelling, and it's called third spacing. And
dehydration.
Dehydration, yeah. Electrolyte imbalances, all that stuff. So the things that Boo is talking about with this patient isn't just a burn. Like when she says that this young woman or girl almost died, it's because there's probably a multiplier of things that are occurring to her at once. So
yeah. So when I got her, she wasn't near death.
Right.
But the way that Dobby explains it, because of what happens after, definitely puts you at risk for a lot of really bad things. Even a burn from a bathtub. I mean, that just goes to show is life-threatening.
If it was a bathtub.
If it was a bathtub. And that's the thing. Who knows what it was?
I think the infection risk alone is like...
Yeah.
It's severely risky to have burns like that just because of the infection risk alone. You could die from the infection by itself. Like, it's so...
Yes.
It's crazy.
They're incredibly hard to treat. They're incredibly hard to treat.
There's also usually a burn that is associated with pediatrics known as stockings, where... they are dipped into boiling pots of water or something like that. And you'll see that they look like socks or stockings that are like thigh-high stockings kind of thing. So it is it's a pretty regular occurrence that they experience when you see that burns from water or liquids look like that. So she gets discharged, Boo. Or you transfer her?
Yeah, I think we flew her out.
Okay. What happens next?
So for her, what happens to her? What happens to...
Everything.
So I don't know what happened to her. I knew that a couple months later I found out that she almost died, and then I never found out after that. I don't know what happened to the parents. I don't know. Because I was the triage nurse, my name wasn't really associated with the chart very much. I think I don't even think I triaged her. I don't think I started the chart is what I mean.
And that matters because, like, you can't see it then.
Well, if nurses got called into court, I wouldn't have been one of them because I wasn't on the chart sort of thing.
Okay.
So I wasn't able to follow the progression of that case. Mm. I guess this is kind of where I was going with that. So I don't know what the outcome was with the child. But I always wonder if she got placed back with her parents because it is incredibly hard to find foster care for patients like that.
Right.
She's autistic. Now she's dealing with these burns that have probably lifelong complications, or at least for the next several years. A lot of times they will go back to the parents that are abusing them.
Yeah, because she's also nonverbal.
Right.
On top of that.
So for me, the first child abuse case that I talked about, it affected me immediately.
Right.
I was a mess. This one, I think I had pushed it so far down, it didn't bother me right away. A couple months later, it hit me, and I just thought about this child all the time. I thought about her nonstop. I thought about how she was doing. I thought about it. My mind sort of went down these rabbit holes of what kind of abuse did she go through? How did she really get those burns? What other kinds of things were her parents doing to her? What kind of sexual abuse did she experience? How many times did they sexually abuse her? And it was just all I thought about. It was all consuming. And at this point, I had two kids. And I thought, you know, it's just, I don't know if, again, you just think of your kids, like, I love my kids so much. They're everything to me. How could you do this to your child? What kind of monsters are in this world?
Well, it's also special needs who you know have, like, a particular, like, they are in a different level of, you could say, innocence or
exactly,
trust. Like, they need someone that they can absolutely trust.
Yes. And I think about her every day. I think the first one was male, the second one was female. I think about him every day.
It comes on a couple months later, and you're thinking about it. How do you cope with it, do you think?
Not well. I don't talk to anybody about it. I think if you ask a nurse what's the worst thing you've ever seen, it always has to deal with the kid. Almost every time it has to deal with the kid. And we just don't talk about it. We don't tell each other those stories. And I don't know if it's because we don't want to hear those stories because it's just another horrible story that you're going to have in the back of your mind. I don't know if it's just that it's so hard to talk about. I don't know. I haven't told this story to very many people. I just sort of keep it to myself. And I don't know that that's so healthy. I mean, I'm still functioning. I still work. But it's heavy.
Right. Yeah. I don't even know that that encompasses the issue at all. Like, if just saying it's heavy, I feel like it's just, it's very difficult to explain.
Yeah.
Do you experience hypervigilance as a parent?
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Is it because of that or just your job?
Just my job. Mm-hmm. Everything is a death trap. Everywhere I look, I'm like, oh my gosh, they could trip and that could go through their eye. Mm-hmm. Or if they go around the corner, somebody could be there and,
right,
you know, get them in their car. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's interesting. I had a conversation. I think a lot of nurses go through this, and maybe you guys probably do too, where you almost become obsessed with it and you're thinking about, this is going to sound so terrible, but ways your kids could die.
Oh, absolutely.
And you have to, like, put a stop to it. I find myself, like, I have to stop thinking about constantly how my kids are going to die or how they could get hurt.
So on the first responder and ex-military world, I was speaking to my therapist about something similar to this. And she says that, like, hypervigilance related to us being paranoid is regular. But on first responders and military, when I go into a restaurant, I have to sit where I can see the door.
Yeah.
So I can see who's coming in and going out, because like, I don't feel safe if I don't see what's happening. So, because on a call, we do work, I would recognize it as semi-rural. I wouldn't call it rural, but we could be waiting for an officer up to 30 minutes, if depending where we're at.
That's scary.
So, when we're in the house, I am always aware if someone else is in there, or if I get suspicious, I will immediately start asking, like, is there other people in this house, kind of thing, because I don't want any surprises.
Yeah.
But she said it's very common for that hypervigilance to come in and to overwhelm us in that sense. I have that with my daughter, and she is almost like, Dad, we've already spoke about this. Like, we got code words, we have plans for intruders into our house, you know, things like that, of what she needs to, like, her goals that she needs to accomplish. And I think we were even talking to someone not too long ago about kids just listening to us, like, I need you to shut the fuck up right now because this is an emergency. You know, kind of, it's not time for, like, why do we need to hide under the counter, Dad? Yeah. That's not, no, they're reloading the gun. Get, just do what I say.
Yeah.
You know,
you're talking about, you told me that yesterday.
Did I tell you that yesterday? So, yeah, it's just one of those things where you hope in the moment that they will listen to everything you say, because I always tell my daughter, like, there's times when you need to ask questions, because I encourage her to challenge authority or question authority, but there are times when we need to be quiet and listen and follow direction. I'm always scared that that will happen, that she'll want to have a conversation in the midst of something that we need to be silently moving. Or
have you been in a scenario where you've had to go?
Not with her. We were, as Oz was setting things up, I was listening to a small little clip of that I posted on the Life on Duty, the crew group page. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about hypervigilance and how almost we will never need it in real life. On the job, it's important. Like, we have to do it because, like, we need to protect ourselves, protect our partners, protect the patients. Nurses might have a hard time relating, because when we're on the highway, like, the highway we're on is kind of dangerous, but when we are on an interstate, people do not slow down. They're doing 70 to 80 miles an hour, and all it takes, even on our highway, the speed limit's not 70, but it's 60, and people are doing 75. And if that even touches us, our career is over. If not, our life is altered forever, if not ended, kind of thing. So I've been in situations where somebody has murdered someone and had a weapon. They were hiding the weapon when we came upon them.
Yeah.
And we didn't know it. And I may have or may not have trespassed into at least three houses at about midnight to 2 a.m. that a resident did not call. And they didn't have numerics visible.
Now, it's only trespassing if they tell you to leave and you don't.
Oh, is that how that works?
Okay. Or they have signs.
So is it breaking and entering then? For just going
in? Did you break?
We did not break.
Did you just enter?
We just entered. Yeah, we just entered. So
then you entered.
Right.
Several strangers' house.
Yeah. So, but I like to clipboard. So I'm like, I'm a paramedic. Sorry about this.
Sure, you are.
I'm trying to contact you about your extended warranty.
That's right. So some of that is reasonable. As you know, you might know that we have a young man that is working with us. He's just turned 18, or he just turned 21. He started with us, I think, when he was 18 years old. And we were on a scene and people were screaming at me. And he told me he was going to go get the glucometer, which was code for he's calling the police. And he didn't come back in time. The cops got to me before they did. And it ended up being a huge disagreement between me and the cops, because the cops thought I knew that they were called. And I was telling them, I don't know why you're here. Everything's under control. Everything's fine. And then they got pissed off because I wouldn't tell them patient information. And he watches this huge 15-minute argument and fight post-patient contact after the patient refused, that the officer telling me I don't know patient rights and I'm violating laws by obstructing their investigation. And, da, 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 and I'm like, you know, you're supposed to fucking be here right now. And then they walk off, and my young partner's like, so I might have called them.
Sorry about that.
It's an important piece of information to have when you're telling somebody they're wrong. So the supervisor arrived, and we advised them that there might be potentially two complaints rather than one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but no, I haven't experienced anything like that in real life. I'm just paranoid. It is part of my PTSD from both my childhood and the job. The job has made me more paranoid than my childhood.
Yeah. So hypervigilance, I think as a woman, and especially when I have my kids, I'm always like, and my kids do not question if I'm like, go, we're getting in the car now. And there have been several situations where we have, because I deal with psych patients all the time,
right.
I can recognize that this guy is high on meth.
Yes.
And he was just in the ER yesterday and he was very violent and we're going to run to the car and you're not going to ask any questions about it. And I've done that twice with my kids and they're just right on. I mean.
But you're probably not at risk then.
Or do I don't know.
Oh, I'm just saying, like, is that's like part of hypervigilance is that we are under the impression that we may be in danger or at risk, but in reality, you're at Schnucks. You'd have time to get away unless you were mean to him, you know, and he's like, I know that nurse.
I look mean all the time. Exactly. Like, I just took care of this dude yesterday and now I'm out with my kids. Like, we got to run.
I will tell my daughter, did you not think that person looks abnormal? Like, I just try to teach her, like, they are clearly on drugs.
How old's your daughter, though?
She's 12.
She's 12. Yeah, so, yeah, you can talk to her.
She should be getting recognized like that usually. But then my kid doesn't know a stranger.
Yes. So
it's really complicated.
Yeah, it's hard. And you also don't want to, like, make the world seem scary.
Yes.
And terrible around every corner. Yeah. So that's scary. My mom raised me in a way to be paranoid at all times anyway. So I just have, like, this baseline of paranoia at all times. Like, eventually you're going to get robbed. Eventually somebody's going to try to rape you. Like, always look behind, you know, look in the back seat, look under your car. Like, yes, all the time. So I've just lived that way.
Well, at least you're equipped for all the bad things in life.
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready to get robbed. Let's do it. Let's get it over with.
You go through the phase of hypervigilance, or you still experience in it. And what about your personal relationships with your children and your spouse? Do you find that they could see that you were affected or acting differently? Or,
man, you know, I'd have to ask my husband. I don't know. That would be a good question for him. My kids, no. I feel like they're too little. I try to shield them from all the bad stuff anyway. I try not to, you know.
So you don't experience, like, shorter fuses or anything like that?
It's hard to say if it's just, you know, raising little kids as well as a short fuse.
Right.
You know, and after working 3 12s in a row, of course I'm going to have a short fuse. Does it make it a little worse if I have a bad patient? Probably. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm going to have to ask my husband tonight.
Did you seek any professional treatment?
So, yeah, I did try to seek some treatment through work, through our EAP program.
Okay.
And they had no counselors available for 6 months.
Okay.
So, it's a joke. It's a joke. The number of times, you know, we've all been in traumatic codes and traumatic events, dealt with horrible child abuse cases. I've had somebody in management check on me after one in my 10 years in the ER.
Oh, okay.
I've never been offered counseling. I've never been offered.
But the EAP number is where, or how do you go about getting it?
It's on the intranet site at work. So you just find it yourself.
It's not posted anywhere.
Oh, you know what? It is posted in the break room now. After COVID, they did start really making sure that was posted.
Yeah, after you're real fucked up after COVID.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it the same EAP organization, do you know? Like, is it the same as it was before? Because I know that was probably a while back.
I don't know.
I'm just curious because if it was pre-COVID, post-COVID, they're probably like, our counselors are on back order right
well,
now.
Well, you know, interest, yeah, that's interesting because they had nurses doing EAP stuff during COVID. So you weren't even talking to a counselor, you're just talking to a nurse who was out for COVID or had got hurt on the job or something. So, you know, maybe that was better to be able to talk to a nurse. But I feel like my COVID experience wasn't as bad as, like, the ICU nurses.
Right.
Those nurses have they've got to have PTSD. I mean, people were dying left and right. I don't know how those nurses are even working today. So I hope they got the counseling that they needed, but I'm sure they didn't.
Right. So they don't reach out to you afterwards, your organization, after the second or
I think
first
that's pretty standard. I don't think that's just my organization.
Yeah, right,
I think
that's
pretty standard.
And you attempt to take it upon yourself to get help through the EAP and they don't have counselors available for 6 months, mm-hmm. did they have an alternative? Were they like, we can't help you right now, but we do have like a secondary backup system where you can call this number? Or was it like, nah, we'll just put you on the waiting
list? No, it was just a wait list. I wasn't offered anything else.
Okay.
No.
You are slightly different when we talk about these traumatic events, just like you mentioned. This is Tuesday at the ER. What do you think that the ER could do to recognize when certain events could potentially affect their employees?
So I really think I think that has to sort of come from within the team. So a group of nurses and I had talked about at one time putting together just a list of names and numbers. Hey, if you have an issue, you can call any of these nurses at any time and we'll talk to you. And we don't have to mention it at work. We don't have to talk about it outside of work. But if you need to talk to somebody right now about a bad experience you had, call one of these nurses.
So an internal peer support.
Yeah.
I like that. That sounds good.
Yeah.
I think that would be a great idea as long as there's training provided with that.
And that's the thing. Yeah. There would be no training. It would just be like, hey, we're free to talk. I don't think everybody would, we never did it. Not everybody was comfortable with doing it.
So you would like to see a peer support program. Is that what you're saying?
Oh yeah, I think it'd be wonderful.
What do you think the participation would be like? Or like, what is the culture at your ER for something like that to be received?
I think the nurses that I've reached out to who have gone through something that I think that they should probably have talked to somebody, or the reaction is usually, I'm fine. I don't need to talk to anybody. I'm fine. And I think it's, I don't know if it's just because it's so fast paced. We don't have time to talk about it during work. You don't want to burden somebody else. You have, you know, the next task to move on. I don't know. I hope it would be well received. I think it would be well received. I don't know.
I think more than likely it's everyone else is doing this just like I'm supposed to be doing this. I don't want to burden other people because they are getting along.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
If I start saying I need to take a break or something like that, then I'm putting a burden on them.
Yes.
Like they have to take my workload over.
Oh yeah. 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 I also think you don't want to feel weak. And I mean that sounds silly. But no, you
I think
oh man,
silly.
You know, even telling my story, I think people have probably gone through such worse things. And I have had worse patients. These
right.
two just affected me in a different way. But maybe nurses don't want to share because they think, oh, you know, Boo has 10 years of experience on me. What's this compared to
yeah.
the things that she's seen? And I hate that, especially for new nurses.
Well, the Fuzz's episode, he talks about on one of his scenes, a senior officer didn't reach out to him. And now that he's a like moderate to senior officer, he wants the change, but he finds himself struggling with making the change happen because that's just what happened. And he openly admitted he doesn't like that, but like the paradigm shift is not
yeah.
easy to accomplish.
Yeah.
It's very difficult. And we had a discussion of like, where does it start? Because somebody has to be the one to put it out there. And it's really difficult to be that person.
Yeah.
It's not easy.
I think it's also difficult to just admit that you can't do your job for a minute.
Yes.
You know.
Did you happen to experience any issues with depression through that time?
Yes. I didn't recognize it at the time. I think, yes. When I reflect on some of those experiences, I think there have been definite times in my career that I've been depressed and didn't realize it. And I guess it did make, you know, now that I think about it, made some of the life experiences that I was going through personally a lot more difficult. Because I think of the darkest times in my life that I was going through personally, I think I was probably also dealing with stuff from work that I thought I had shut out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it all compounded and I had a rough time.
That compartmentalizing failing, as you spoke earlier.
Yeah, yeah. You have to do it, but you have to, I mean, it is a fine balance. It's hard. It comes out in unexpected ways, I think.
Are you comfortable with sharing how your depression manifested?
I probably withdrew from friends and family mm-hmm. more than I should have or wanted to. probably, like you had mentioned, more short-fused with my poor husband and probably my friends. I think just keeping it in too much to right. the point where I didn't want to go out and do anything.
Mm-hmm. Isolation is a very good indication. And what's really bizarre about that isolation is we don't realize it in the moment.
Right.
We just think like, oh, we need like another day to just be by ourselves kind of thing. Or I want to be in bed today because I deserve it.
And yes. And that's exactly how I deserve this. I need this time. I deserve this. Yeah.
And then it's not like a self-care thing. It's a, I don't want to get out of bed tomorrow either.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Or it takes me 8 hours to get out of bed. Or
yeah. Yeah. And all of a sudden you hadn't seen your friends in, you know, a month.
Yeah. It? Yeah. Especially if you have good enough friendships where like you don't have to speak for every day.
Yes.
You know, and it's not abnormal for you guys not to, I mean, Oz and I would talk, we probably talk weekly, but like now that Life on Duty's on, I would say almost daily, if not.
Hourly?
Huh?
Hourly?
Hourly, wow.
From me. Yeah. My girlfriend's like, go see your boyfriend.
You guys might as well just move in together.
Yeah, right. He's got the space for it.
Or at least move to my city.
Huh?
Or at least move to my city.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Just walk across the street or something.
So earlier you had mentioned whenever you were talking about like, speaking to someone about like something you just encountered and you're comparing yourself to like someone who might be a newer nurse or someone who might be an even more experienced nurse than you. The problem with that mentality is like trauma's super, it's case by case.
Yeah.
So it's the trauma that you experience during in relation to the experience you have.
Right.
So, and not just nursing experience, but life experience in general.
Yeah.
So it's like, just because Dobby goes to a side-by-side wreck and it catches on fire and he sees the same thing I saw, doesn't mean it's going to affect him the exact same way it's going to affect me, even if we had the exact same experience in EMS.
Right.
Like, we have different life experiences too.
Right.
So that could have been the most traumatizing thing I've ever seen, but he used to work on a racetrack and dealt with that all the time, so it's like, it's
man, that's fucked up. And
then
going to cheeseburger. This was mild compared to last week.
Right. Yeah, right. I've seen that. I've been in code situations where the rest of us are like off to the side making a joke, which is normal in healthcare.
Yeah,
any listeners, or would you know that's a normal thing?
Just
I know
for all intents and purposes,
a
code is a dead person, by the way. I just want, just put that out
but
there.
But then you see this other nurse that's just devastated and she's just, you know, trying to figure out what's going on and what she should do. And she looks horrified. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're over here talking about what we're going to have for lunch.
Right.
And so for her, it is very traumatic. For us, it is just another day.
So an interesting thing about EMS is the family is present probably 60% of the time.
Yes, so there's no family. So let me preface, there's no family in the room while we're talking about
it. So the pro face stays on, but where we work at is a lot of volunteer firefighters and they don't get paid to be professional. They get paid to, or they don't even get paid to help sometimes. You know, it's just they're putting their free time. So it's like this fine line of them. We're like, hey guys, we got to keep pro face on for a little bit. There's like, you know, some stuff here. But as soon as EMS and fire is the exact same way, as soon as like family exits, you know, it's like, hey, what are you guys doing this weekend? How you been?
Yeah.
I haven't seen you in a while, you know, kind of stuff. Did you ever feel like you weren't in control?
There have been times that I felt on and off the job that I wasn't in control.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that you blamed things for that?
I think if I was going to blame anything, I would think that maybe like, oh, maybe it was time for my period and I was just really emotional. And that's why, I tried to sort of find some sort of reason for why I was feeling the way that I was feeling instead of just being okay with what I was feeling.
Mm-hmm. In retrospect, do you think it wasn't that?
No, it wasn't that.
Okay.
No.
Do you find that you still do that? Like when you have a rough time, you're like, oh, my period's going around. This is what's happening. Or is it like like I said, I told myself previously it was my period, but I actually have these emotions inside of me that I'm working through.
No.
No what?
I think I still try to brush it off. Like,
oh, okay.
Oh, this is just a bad day, or this is just, I still don't recognize it. And retrospectively, I will, but I don't know if that's just because I'm hard-headed. I don't know. No, I'm not better at that. I wish I was.
Yeah. When I asked earlier if you went to go get professional help. You said you tried the EAP?
Yes.
Did you try anything after that outside of your organization?
So I have seen a counselor a couple of times that I paid for myself. And it was okay. It was sort of helpful. I find it to be more helpful when I talk to other nurses.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I'm not alone. And I feel like, oh, you have these same emotions. You had the same reaction. It's a normal part of this profession. And I feel better about that.
Do you find that you are still struggling with these two scenarios that we're discussing today?
You know, it's interesting talking about it. I thought I was just going to be bawling and it was going to be hard because after you asked me to be on this episode, I thought about it all night. I thought about how I was going to tell my story. And the next day when I went to work, I was talking to a friend. And I said, I don't think I can do it. I think I'm going to have to message him and say, like, I can't do it. It's too much. She was like, that's fine. Yeah, it's totally fine. So I thought, no, I'm going to do this. He asked me to be on the show. I'm very honored. Of course, I'm going to do it. I think it's going to be therapeutic for me. And I just shut it off until today.
I do want to make it clear that, like, there is no obligation or commitment to anyone on Life on Duty if you're thinking about telling the story or if you've already agreed, because we do not want anyone to feel that way. We want to...
I think it's normal to feel that way because you're exposing a very personal thing to you. And I think that is normal to feel that way.
Okay.
And so I think for me, I'm really glad that I came on and I shared my story because it's very therapeutic.
You think so?
Yeah.
What do you think organizations or hospitals need in place? You said a peer support group is a good thing.
Yeah.
Any other ideas or suggestions?
I definitely think a counselor on staff or somebody that you can talk to within like 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody that you can get a hold of and talk through your emotions. And I think also recognizing that it's okay to step away if you need a day off, if you need to take some time away. We go through these traumatic things, these codes, these child abuse cases, and then you go right to the next patient who may have a sore throat or mm-hmm. a toe pain or, you know, whatever. And there really should be a break in between, even for a very experienced nurse. That's hard to go through something traumatic, shut it off, and then take care of somebody who has strep throat.
Right.
You know, for example.
Absolutely.
And give good care.
Smile on your face.
You know, because even though it's just a sore throat to them, that might be the worst day of their life. And my job is to make you feel better and to help you. Do I think you should be in the emergency room for a sore throat? No.
Right.
But you're having a bad day. I want to be able to make you feel more comfortable and better about, you know, what you're going through at that moment.
One of the odd pleasures that I have about our job is that I enjoy deeply that particular aspect. But our job is very different than yours, where you guys are fucking going nonstop most of the time. And we have time to chill out. You know, we're not buried in patients usually like the ER is. And I like the idea of like going to people's houses and they have no idea that like we were picking people up off the street, you know, 30 minutes ago and then we're showing up to there. And I don't know if it's like an ego thing, but I feel like a pride in that sometimes whenever I'm able to do that for people. But I understand that completely because I feel like there are scenarios, I think we talk about it, where there should be some relief time offered in some shape, way, or form.
Or just like right after the call, you go to the gas station, whatever, he's asking you,
oh, how's the night going?
What's the worst thing you've ever seen? That stupid fucking question we hear all the time.
But it's nothing that we can fault the public for.
No.
Until they're educated about why it's a bad thing. Yeah. Which is, I'm kind of hoping Life on Duty will allow people to look behind the scenes of stuff like that and realize, like, there's better questions asked than that kind of thing.
Or just don't ask me any questions. We don't.
That's fine, too. Fuzz talks about how he does not want to talk about work.
Oh,
if he's not at work.
I don't either. Yeah, I don't want to talk about it at all. I'm not a nurse when I'm not at work.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about work. I don't want to talk about it.
It's hard not to talk about the stuff that's like, dude, I finally got to do this.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, I started my
milestones.
My first EJ like a year ago or something like that. Those big
Yeah, in the beginning of your career.
You're talking down to me?
It is very...
No. I'm relating. Because I can remember a lot of that stuff.
I feel like it's a difference in job. My girlfriend is a nurse. And she is like... Oz, your wife's the same way where she's like envious because of... how much we love our jobs and excited we are to like do our job, you know, and to be around the people we work with, because like, it's just like what we were talking about before the show started. Like we just have a different level of relationships, it seems like, than the ER has the ability to have.
She tells other nurses all the time, imagine loving your job like my husband does. Imagine it.
You're getting paid to hang out with your friends.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You just saw them. I was working. What are you talking about?
It's like legitimate that I'm pretty sure Oz and I are like, he likes to tell people when we introduced each other that he slept with me the first time he met me because we shared a bed at a hotel. So he likes to, you know, he likes to tell people stuff like that. But it's literally like the time that Oz and I spend together exceeds our spouse's time.
I believe
by
it.
A great deal. Yeah,
I believe
it. Yeah, it's crazy. So peer support, a counselor, and anything else? An EAP system that doesn't have 6-month wait?
Yeah, hopefully that's better now.
What'd you say?
Hopefully it's better.
A Keurig?
A Keurig.
Yeah. We have one of those, actually. Yeah, I think also maybe just like monthly, every 3-month quarterly check-ins from our supervisor.
That's good. I like that.
Yeah.
That is good.
Just, hey, how is your mental health? Not talking about like, this is what you're doing well, this is what you're... How are you doing? How are you coping? Is everything going okay? Do you feel mentally well?
So in the hierarchy of nursing, are you referring to like a charge nurse? That's like your direct supervisor, right?
Yeah,
and then
for
there's
us.
Like a,
I mean,
and then there's a higher one than that.
Yeah.
Which one are you referring to?
Probably the higher one than that.
Okay. So the person above the charge nurse.
Yeah, because they would also be in charge of saying, I really think you need to take a couple PTO days off. How about you take a week off?
You think they're familiar enough with you to make that kind of decision?
No.
So how would they go about that then?
I don't know. I'd have to put some thought into that. I don't know if it would be filling out, you know, a particular questionnaire. I don't know if it's just the nurse being forthcoming with the supervisor. I feel like I know my supervisors pretty well and they could recognize it in me, but maybe not some of the newer nurses or some of the night shift nurses.
Yeah, because that lady's not there at night shift, right?
Because what?
The person you're talking about is not there at night shift.
No.
Right. Yeah. So they don't have a lot of interaction with the night shift nurses. So I don't know exactly how that would work.
Do you think the charge nurse should have been included in that conversation?
The charge nurse does so much already.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful. But man, to add something else on their plate, it's a lot.
So I'm going to tell you how I feel, and you let me know if you think it would be unreasonable or not. I feel that any type of leadership, whether it's charge nurses, supervisor, for us, ER managers, they should be trained to be able to recognize these type of things and also know what steps they need to take.
Where are we at on a scale of severity?
Like formal training. Mm-hmm. Like they have to do it before they can even start acting as a supervisor.
I love that. I think that is a fantastic idea.
Do you guys in the ER, are you familiar with CISD? Or
no.
CISM, so critical incident stress debriefing?
No.
You don't recognize that term?
No.
Critical incident stress management?
No.
Okay. So I guess like in the pre-hospital world, it exists where you have a severe incident and it depends. It's measured. It can be measured based on how well your admin knows your employees, or there's a standard outline like any pediatric deaths, things like that, just as a form of measurement. And within the first 24 hours, you have... I think it's known as like a hot debriefing where you're going to sit down, have a small meeting about what happened, talk about how people feel, and then a follow-up happens in about a week to 2 weeks kind of thing. And I just find it interesting that an in-hospital setting would not have that because the training, I think, is free here.
Where do you go for it?
It's in the state of Missouri. Life on Duty is putting it together a team. We want everybody. We want somebody from everywhere to be kind of part of that so that we have a good, diverse group of people.
Yeah.
And it's just something that's super valuable. And
yeah.
Being able to sit down, that you're talking to your peers about it. You're not talking to a counselor, you know, that doesn't know your job or anything like that. Somebody said, was that the Fuzz talking about they had a CISD and a counselor came in and it was a joke? Yeah. And it was nobody that knew anything about the job. So that CISD experience was like a bad experience. So we're hoping to create a scenario where that's going to be possible.
So you're trying to put together like a local team that would come into hospitals, or how would it work?
Well, you know, the monsters of the hospital is a little different. So, but like we will have a team established, hopefully by August, we're going to be able to provide to the surrounding organizations that are not in hospital. We are looking to get into the hospital, but we just know that the legalities of that and
the fight that it would take is going to be a little bit different.
Okay.
But that's not something we're going to give up on. It's because you guys are on our list of important individuals too. So we do want to address it. And if push comes to shove, you know, we'll find loopholes to where we just find out it happens outside and then we just put on like a meeting.
Yeah.
And then just find a place to do it so that we can facilitate it for people if their organization's not going to do it, because honestly, fuck them. But I just wanted to mention that because you didn't seem to mention it. And I don't know. The hospital world is so different than pre-hospital world. It's so crazy. Like we're both emergency medicine, but it's so very vastly different.
Yeah, I think the closest thing to that is post-code pause. And I think you and I have talked about this. It's been a long, long time ago. But I did some research about it when I was getting my bachelor's. And basically just the things that you need to do after going through a pediatric death, a code, or, you know, whatever, to pause, reflect, talk about the things you did well, talk about what you could be doing different. Does anybody need a break? Is everybody doing okay?
That's after every code that you're supposed to do
We
that?
Should do that yeah. after every code. I've probably done it after five.
That the crazy thing about that, Boo, is that we call that just debriefing.
Yeah.
So anytime I have when Oz was a student with me, it starts out as every single call we debrief because he just needs feedback, you know. But as his capstone goes, we start debriefing more focused on serious calls or talk about if that call could have evolved into something more serious, how would we done it better kind of thing. And it is such a valuable tool because it's not only insightful, but I think it's healthy because you can evaluate.
Yeah.
Our peers know who we are, even if they don't like us. They know who we are.
Yeah.
So, any parting words or words of wisdom that you would like to share with the ER world or first responders in general?
I think the only thing I was going to close with this, but you asked me about it earlier, is just remembering that the world is good. It's not a bad, dark, scary place out there. It's really not. We talk about hypervigilance and how we're sort of always on edge, how we're always sort of looking behind our back or looking down the street to see if that is that a patient that I took care of. I really, truly believe that people are good and they are kind and they want what's best for everybody else. I really believe that. And you have to hold on to that in this field because it is dark.
Yeah, it gets dark fast.
It gets really dark really fast.
Well, Boo, I knew you were really nervous about coming out today, and Oz and I just want to thank you for making yourself vulnerable and put in a position of hopefully growth rather than trauma or, you know, any pain or suffering that you might experience. We hope that this was not what you expected it to be and that it was a little bit better than that, and we just want to thank you. You are the first nurse we've had here at hospital nurses and pre-hospital paramedics. We're pretty fortunate with the relationship that we have in our area with most of you guys. It's not that like that everywhere. And we just want to thank you for coming out and even reaching out to our fellow first responders that have no idea what it's like to have a good relationship with ER staff. I think that's really important. So just thanks for coming out today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Life on Duty. If you're interested in sharing a personal story you have and how it affected you, please email us at lifeondutypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the shit we discuss and want to hear more, follow us and give us something better than a 1-star rating. If you believe in what's unfolding here, check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/lifeonduty, or use the link in the show notes below.